Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. I'm not much of a Christmas shopper, but this year I noticed that my husband's favorite wool crew neck pullover sweater, which he's had for decades, is threadbare. It's not really warm anymore. It's pretty much falling apart. Same with a pair of leather slippers with shearling lining. I got him about 12 years ago. So I first checked the family-owned department store in our little town, and since they didn't have these two items, I went online to find them. And that is when I discovered something very interesting. I ended up going, since I can't find an all-wool crew neck men's pullover sweater, Shetland, you know, just something ordinary that used to be everywhere. Well, I ended up checking all these sites of our big-name chains. And if you look at the customer reviews for those two items, what you see in company after company after company site is people saying, well, I ordered one of these sweaters. It's okay. It's much thinner than the one I had for 20 years. It's not nearly the quality. And some say they'll keep it, and some say they'll send it back. And with the slippers, they say, oh, I bought a pair of these, but they fell apart in 4 months or 6 months, so I sent them back. And you see that again and again. So it's clearly a case of the quality getting squeezed and ratcheted down, a race to the bottom, so that the pressure for the profits can be met, always increasing profits so that the share value of the company will go up every quarter, and the executive pay is tied to that. So that got me thinking about all the squawking we hear coming out of Washington and elsewhere from the Republicans, who say, as if it were a matter of fact, well, it's always more efficient to privatize everything. You know, move everything from the public sector, or even the nonprofit sector, which is not the government sector, move it all into the for-profit sector, and then you get efficiency. But of course, what you get is the pressure of a big, fat layer of profit that has to be built in. And everything's going to get squeezed, the workers, the product, the services, before the profit gets squeezed. So, you know, I really started wondering about why the right keeps getting away with this. That is, why the media lets the right get away with it, and also why people aren't contacting Congress a lot more on this. And I just actually started racking my brain to think if there has been a single public service area in which efficiency has ever been increased by privatizing it. You know, all the city municipal bus lines they would put into private contractors' hands, and pretty soon, oh, well, we got to eliminate some of those lines. It's just not working with our profit. And we got to cut the driver's pay, and we got to increase the fares. So it's really happening in every area. You know, take healthcare providers, for instance. I mean, the healthcare insurance corporations take a lot more of the public's money than Medicare does for the same services. And that's for the obvious reason of that profit layer on top of meeting their overhead expenses. Medical administrative costs as a percentage of claims are about 3 times higher for private insurance than for Medicare. And moreover, the for-profit healthcare system wastes about $750 billion a year on waste, fraud, and inefficiency. And in this vein, there's a very good article I happened to notice yesterday in the Los Angeles Times by Michael Hiltzik, and it's about the apparent growing consensus in the fiscal cliff debates and discussions in Washington that raising the age for Medicare from 65 to 66 or maybe 67 would be a fairly painless way to achieve fiscal responsibility. Now, mind you, growing consensus, he means a lot of Democrats are on board with that. And he points out that the people pushing for that say, well, this would save the federal budget $5.7 billion in 2014 alone. But, as he notes, calculations such as these typically are made to look good by considering only one side of the ledger, the side showing the cost to the government accounts, often only the short-term cost. This is a handy trick that can be applied to almost any situation. Has the government spent too much on maintaining roads and bridges? Oh, spend less. This does wonders for the federal budget. Of course, it does horrors for the budgets of everyone else. What's on the other side of the Medicare age ledger? Plenty. As the Kaiser Family Foundation calculated last year, health insurance for 5 million people would be affected for at least a year. Of that group, 42% would stay on their employer's insurance, including some retirees. 38% would buy private insurance through the exchanges set up under the 2010 Health Care Reform Act, and 20% would land on Medicaid. Two-thirds would pay more for insurance than they would have paid under Medicare, for an aggregate net increase of out-of-pocket costs of $3.7 billion. The shift of more elderly members into the commercial insurance pool would drive up premiums for the non-elderly by an average of $141 per enrollee. Costs to employers of keeping those workers in their plans would rise by $4.5 billion a year, and Medicaid costs for states would rise by $700 million. By the way, the higher costs would hit the middle-class seniors especially hard. Put it all together, as health economist Austin Frank did, and you find that saving $5.7 billion on the federal books would cost society as a whole $11.4 billion. So, unfortunately, we're not hearing this from the media, but I hope this sets off red alarms and that you will contact your Congress people who are involved in any way with leaning on these discussions about whether they should raise the eligibility age for Medicare. But, as I say, this is happening in all areas. The second area is retirement savings. The fact is that administrative costs for 401k plans are much higher than those for Social Security, up to 20 times higher. And a third area is banking and finance. We're all aware that the economic crash of 2008 was caused by a Wall Street racket of hustling nearly worthless securitized mortgages, and that far from not knowing that most of those subprime mortgages were going to default, the Wall Street firms kept putting pressure on the mortgage brokers on the ground level to keep lowering the standards for qualifying, because the Wall Street firms said they need more product to bundle and sell around the world. So, of course, that was one large part of the crash, the cause for it. And the other was that reckless gambling by the Wall Street firms and many of their hapless customers on derivatives and collateralized debt obligations. And then the crisis in student loan debt has occurred solely because a fat layer of profit for the banks was inserted instead of allowing students to borrow directly from the government or community-supported banks, which I'll get to in a moment. there have been a lot of other private sector scandals in recent years, such as the phony ratings of the securities and the manipulating of the international interest rate for banks, that acronym LIBOR. And they keep saying the public sector is inefficient. Really? For whom? Now, one ray of hope in the banking sector is that the unique Bank of North Dakota has been getting a lot of attention. North Dakota is the only state to own its own depository bank. It was founded in 1919 by Norwegian immigrants and others who had a strong sense of the efficient collective action for the common good. That was the way to go, and were they right? The bank pays no bonuses, fees, or commissions. It does no advertising. It has only the one main office in the state capital. What it does is offer inexpensive lines of credit to local and state government agencies, resulting in low-cost loans for financing public projects. The Bank of North Dakota underwrites municipal bonds, funds disaster relief, and makes possible low-cost student loans. Take a look at its website. It's a very happy student pictured on it. It partners with local commercial banks and communities to increase lending, and it pays competitive interest rates on state deposits. for the past 10 years, it's been paying a dividend to the state coffers of $30 million a year. Now, because of this wisely structured state-owned bank, North Dakota did not suffer nearly as much as other states during the credit crunch and the economic collapse of 2008 and 9 and on. So 19 other states are now studying this model, as is the government of Scotland, as a possible way to restructure the Bank of Scotland, if they can get it back when it crashed because their bankers had been caught up in the scams and participated. It was confiscated by the UK government, who handed it over to Lloyd's of London to administer. So you can imagine the Scots are not happy with that. So this sort of ray of hope shining out from the Bank of North Dakota does not exist yet in other areas where privatization is victimizing people at a fast clip. I mean, such as the many new for-profit vocational training schools and for-profit colleges and institutes, which claim to be fully accredited but are not. And that leaves their graduates and their dropouts alike with big student loan debt and no hopes for the type of job or career they thought they were training for. If you know anyone considering one of those for-profit schools, have them contact the State Department of Education and find out if they're really fully accredited, regardless of what they say. Well, I mention all these examples only to encourage everyone to speak up whenever you hear someone claim that government programs are always wasteful and privatizing the production and delivery of services and even a lot of goods is often always more efficient. You know, that simply isn't true. And moreover, a distinction should always be made, I think, when we're speaking about the private sector, between for-profit companies and non-profit entities. I mean, just consider for a moment the area of healthcare and, say, hospice care. Does anyone really think that putting a big fat layer of profit into the structure of a hospice providing company with pressure annually to increase the profits won't squeeze the quality of the service people need? Well, my guest today is someone who has done a lot to help people see the moral and spiritual imperative behind taking action to challenge these assumptions and to fix the structure that's causing damage to so many lives. Rabbi Michael Lerner is with us today. He holds two PhDs, one in philosophy and the other in clinical psychology. He serves as director of the Institute for Labor and Mental Health in Berkeley, California. Regarding his life of engaged spirituality, Rabbi Michael Lerner was mentored by Abraham Joshua Heschel at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York. He received rabbinic ordination from Rabbi Zalman Schachter Sholomei, and he now serves as rabbi of Beit Tikkun in Berkeley, a Jewish renewal synagogue that is post-denominational and committed to an emancipatory and love-oriented Judaism. He's also founder of Beit Midrash LeShalom in Jerusalem. Rabbi Michael Lerner is the co-founder, with Nan Fink, of Tikkun magazine. And right on the cover, it translates that Hebrew word for everyone, their meaning, as they see it, to heal, repair, and transform the world. So he's the co-founder of Tikkun and serves as the editor of both their print issues and its online magazine. Tikkun magazine celebrated its 25th anniversary of publication last year. So hats off to perseverance and its continuing high quality. Michael Lerner was identified by Utney Reader as one of America's 100 most significant visionaries and by Newsweek as one of America's most influential rabbis. He's also the chair of the Network of Spiritual Progressives, a noteworthy organization we'll be hearing about in the second half of the program. Michael Lerner is the author of 11 books, including Jewish Renewal, The Politics of Meaning, spirit matters, and the left hand of God. He also co-authored a book with Cornel West entitled Jews and Blacks. His most recent book, published last year, is Embracing Israel / Palestine, A Strategy to Heal and Transform the Middle East. Rabbi Michael Lerner, welcome to the program. If you're there, but I'm getting messages from the sound engineer at PRN that they're having trouble. He was on the line and then it was lost. I think they're going back and forth. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit more about his work, and he'll come on when he comes on. The first thing I wanted to ask him about, since we're in the season of Hanukkah, is this great piece that was posted on the Tikkun website, is still there, posted on December 6th, called How to Do Hanukkah 2012. And Rabbi Lerner wrote, Hanukkah is the holiday celebrating the triumph of hope over fear, light over darkness, the powerless over the powerful. It begins this Saturday night, December 8th, and ends at dark on Sunday, December 16th. So he says that you can tell the story in one way. It's more powerful than the way he's thinking about what he's going to present. He says it's more powerful than the current Americanization of Hanukkah, which he describes as, quote, they oppressed us, we beat them, now let's show how much we can spend on gifts and let's eat latkes. Unquote. No, he says, recognize that Hanukkah is about understanding that when we connect with the transformative power of the universe, the force of healing and transformation, we become aware that the powerless can become powerful, that oppression of any sort is in contradiction to the fundamental nature of human beings as loving, kind, generous, free, creative, intelligent, attuned to beauty, caring for and needing each other, beings created in the image of God. Still trying to get him, so let me go on. When that energy and awareness permeates our consciousness, no ruling elite and no system of exploitation can possibly last for very long. Now, the formal way, lighting one candle the first night, then adding an additional one to the left of the first one each night, always starting on the right-hand side of the menorah as it's facing you, moving more and more to the left each night. He says, you know, do this, but dedicate each night to a liberation theme. So for the first night, he says, why not meditate on this theme? End the domination of oil and coal. Dedicate this night to working out plans to challenge the energy industry and to demand that the Obama administration and Congress seriously address global warming with minimum, at the minimum, a significant tax on carbon use. Yeah, you betcha, a carbon tax. But also plan how you will move yourself from fossil fuel energy for your home to wind and solar. And I would add to that, take a look at the website for 350.org. They've got a big event coming up. I would say protest, but it's more positive than that. It's about saving what we can save of the planet for ourselves and posterity. It's coming up, I think, in February. But they've got a big petition going on now, so take a look there, 350.org, for the climate change action. Okay, back to his Hanukkah meditations on the second night. Think about this. Challenge the materialism and orgy of consumption that happens around these December holidays each year. Instead of giving gifts of things, give gifts of time or energy. For example, my gift to you this year, you might tell your friends, is to give you 4 hours of my time to, oh, take your kids out to the park while you go out, or just take care of them while you have an evening on the town, or I'll mow your lawn, I'll repair your back deck, fix your broken lamp, something like that. And then on the third night, he says, why not this theme? Recommit to peace and justice for both sides in the Middle East. Read the last chapter of his new book, Embracing Israel / Palestine. And I'll get to that in a minute. Send a letter to President Obama and your senators and congressperson telling them that the U.S. must stop siding with the Netanyahu government, he advises, and instead support the peace movement in Israel. So challenge the violence-oriented people on both sides. Recommit to support only strategies that rely on nonviolence. And do this with compassion for the Jewish people, including the Israeli people who are still recovering from centuries of psychic wounding and deserve compassion, not just criticism. So, for the fourth night, Rabbi Michael Lerner, are you with us now?
Yes, I am.
Well, wonderful. Why don't you step in and finish these wonderful meditations for Hanukkah? We're on night four here.
I'd have to bring it up on my computer.
Okay, well, you can talk about it. I'll go through it, and then you can talk about the whole thing. Rededicate your energy and global poverty.
Yes.
So lots of examples there, including this global Marshall Plan we're going to get to in the second half. And then on the fifth night, rededicate your life to expressing love and caring energy wherever it's needed. Do acts of unprovoked loving kindness to strangers, but equally difficult for many, to your parents, children, and people who may not have been kind to you. And then on the sixth night, welcome the immigrants. Demand that the media start considering a more radical approach to immigration, namely the elimination of all laws blocking immigrants from coming in and getting jobs. And, again, it's a reference to the Global Marshall Plan we'll get to. The seventh night, rededicate your energies to celebrating the wonder and mystery of the universe by celebrating Shabbat. We spend so much of our energies on what isn't right in the world, but on Shabbat we get 25 hours to celebrate the beauty and goodness of all of creation, including ourselves and each other. And then the eighth night, rededicate your life to serving God or the spiritual / ethical energy of the universe, however you perceive her / him / it, by living in love, generosity of spirit, compassion, forgiveness, and joy, fully aware and fully present to the gifts that we receive every moment from the force of life and goodness. Serve God by being the most holy and loving being you can be. Accept that you are enough, there is enough, and that we can share and take care of each other. So I thought that was a beautiful way to work our way into your life work here, a lot of which is focused on these 25 years. I mentioned earlier that last year Tikkun magazine celebrated its 25th anniversary, which is so admirable. It's such a high-quality journal, and so many journals that had a good idea at the heart of it just petered out along the way. But Tikkun is in there for the long haul, and I want to congratulate you on that. And I'll also say that in the special 25th anniversary issue, which was winter 2011, I was honored to be invited to contribute a piece, and listeners to this program won't be surprised to hear that I wrote on the relational worldview. Mm-hmm. It's true, I was in the middle of writing my book, Relational Reality, but looking back, I see I was always writing about relational reality in all my books, and it seems to me that that's the focus, too, of Tikkun, a relational perception of what's going on, a relational vision of what we could move toward. Mm-hmm. So
yes.
Is that an accurate perception of Tikkun
Absolutely,
magazine?
Absolutely, Charlene. That's why you and I are soulmates.
Yeah.
We're completely aligned in at that and many other levels of our being. This is what you say in your book is deep and brilliant and wonderful. Everybody should read it.
Oh, well, but back to the magazine. When you started it, Did you have a sense of the arc it was going to take, or how have things changed?
Not really. I didn't, because I thought we were going to be more accepted than we more the voice of Jewish liberals, and not just the voice of Jewish progressives, which we've ended up being. And the thing is that we started in 1986, and at that point, on our board, we had representatives from every strand of Judaism, and we were trying to be sort of the voice of the liberal voice of Jews who were critical of the Reagan administration and of the move on the part of a section of the Jewish world towards the right, the section that had was most prominent in the media, because the media continues to only quote the organized Jewish community and particularly its most conservative institutions and spokespeople as though they represented the rest of us. So that was our goal, was to provide a different voice. But originally we had a very broad spectrum of support. What happened that undermined that was that 2 years later the Intifada began in Palestine, as Palestinians started to demand an end to the occupation. And at that point, we had a big choice to make, and the choice was either to support the demand for an end to the occupation and the creation of a Palestinian state, or to try to ignore the issue, to focus on social justice in the United States, but not look at what was happening so much in Israel-Palestine, and to take a kind of centrist view on that. Well, it was impossible for me to simply ignore the suffering of the Palestinian people. And so we came out very strongly on the side of ending the occupation, of creating a Palestinian state, of dealing directly with the PLO at the time. And we got labeled as a radical, anti-Semitic, self-hating Jews. And so many of the people who had originally been part of our enterprise couldn't stand the heat of that. And so even though they privately would tell me that they really agreed with what I was saying, and they really supported it, but that they felt that they couldn't be identified with it publicly. And so over the years in the Jewish world, we've been excoriated and redefined as out of the mainstream, even though in fact our views have the views that they thought were so radical are now accepted by the mainstream. But this is something I experienced also during the struggle against the war in Vietnam, that those of us who were out there most strongly opposing the war in the 60s found that our views were accepted by the liberal mainstream in the 70s, but they still hated us.
Over time, everybody seems to say, oh, yes, nobody liked that war.
Right, exactly.
Whereas, but they still
resented us. They still had anger at us, who are the ones who forced them to recognize how immoral and destructive that war really was.
Shoot the messenger,
So that it was very different from where we started out. And then the second issue was that we had a main reason for starting the magazine was our concern about the inability of the liberal and progressive forces to understand the spiritual dimension of reality, and in particular understand that human beings don't only have needs for economic entitlements and political rights, although we're totally behind the liberal and progressive agenda on those questions, but that they also have meaning needs, a needs for a meaning to life, a sense of connection to something that goes beyond making it in American society, or even having equal amounts of material well-being. I'm of course totally, and we were totally for that, but we said, no, there's another dimension to human need. And unfortunately, because the liberal and progressive forces don't address that, many, many people have moved to the right politically. So because they hear in the right talking in a language that articulates some concern over those directions. And what we so that was another goal of our magazine, but I think we underestimated at the beginning how deep the religiophobia is in the liberal and progressive world.
That's right. Well, do I know. Since we have limited time, and there's so many things I want to ask you about, and you mentioned the Israeli and Palestinian situation.
Yes.
Let's talk about your most recent book, Embracing Israel / Palestine, because mm-hmm. it's got a lot of endorsements by people who say this is really what's necessary, these insights. I don't see, having read the book, how we can really move forward without addressing the mm-hmm. insights in this book. So can you tell the listeners about your perspective?
Well, I mean, the first thing is that I try to tell the story of how this whole situation developed mm-hmm. in a way that recognizes the humanity of the Israelis and the humanity of the Palestinians, and avoids what you hear almost, first of all, on every college campus, but also in most other places, too, radical polarization in which one side is insists that they are the righteous victims and the other side is the evil other. And this comes from both sides of that struggle. And what I did in this book was to show you how you could see what the legitimacy of the Palestinian narrative and the legitimacy of the Israeli narrative, and not have to conclude that one or the other is an evil demon or a fundamentally awful and misguided force.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I also tried to show how both sides are screwed up, and that it's
We're going to have to pause here for a break, but I just want to say what you said. You tell the story from 1880 up to 2011, that both sides have a legitimate narrative, and both have been unnecessarily cruel and insensitive to the other, and both have been really hurt and damaged by the other. So that is so key, because people often feel nobody knows what we went through. Nobody understands how we suffered. So you name that for both sides. But we have to pause there, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Sure.
This is Charlene Spratnak speaking with my guest, Rabbi Michael Lerner, on All Together Now. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spratnak speaking with my guest, Rabbi Michael Lerner. His website, by the way, is that of his magazine, tikkun.org, TIKKUN.org. So let's get back to your most recent book, Embracing Israel / Palestine. So after you tell the historic narrative of both sides and name the suffering and also the transgressions, then where do you go in the book?
Well, then I go to, first of all, analyzing the contemporary post-traumatic stress disorder that is facing both peoples. Mm. And in particular, I think it's critical that we understand that dimension of the reality, because many people who want to solve the problem are think that they can do that by trying to show that one side or the other is ethically wrong. And mm-hmm. And to focus on the ethics of the issues. Now, in my view, both sides are ethically wrong, at least in many aspects of their behavior. But it doesn't get us very far, that there needs to be a level of compassion towards both sides in order to move forward. I then go on to talk about what a political settlement would look like if you came at it from the standpoint of generosity and caring for each side. What would be the term, the political terms, but I then go on beyond that to say, look, the political terms are irrelevant unless we can approach the whole thing in a spirit of open-hearted generosity and caring. And that is not likely to happen in the Middle East unless there is a fundamental change in the issue of how people perceive what it takes to be secure in the world. So from there I go to argue that homeland security all over the world can only be achieved through a new spirit of generosity. And there I outline the Global Marshall Plan as one dimension of what that generosity would look like when the advanced industrial countries take some responsibility for ending the poverty, homelessness, hunger, inadequate education, inadequate health care that exists for billions of people on this planet. Mm-hmm. And in particular, a call for a global Marshall Plan that would start in the Middle East, and that act of generosity on the part of advanced industrial countries would break the so-called common sense that people have that everybody's just out for themselves. Because as long as everybody's just out for themselves, and that's the common sense, and that they're willing to do whatever they need to do to protect themselves, and what they think they need to do to protect themselves is to get domination and power over others, nobody is going to trust anybody. And that's that's why everything is breaking down in this world. That's why we have the environmental crisis being unresolvable, because we can't get the different parts of the world together to sit down and say, what are we going to do together? Because half of the world is suffering from immediate starvation, hunger, economic desperation. So there's no sense of there being a we, W-E, a togetherness, a shared community. You can't have that unless you pay attention to the actual suffering that people are in. So,
yeah, I think we would also need to pay attention to I'm thinking of an article I wrote after 9/11 about people saying, oh, the Islamic world, they're against modernity. And I thought, you know, what an odd thing to say. A lot of people in the Western world are critiques of the destruction that modernity has done, the destruction of community and the, you know, everyone in it for their own possibilities, sink or swim.
Yeah.
And I think any kind of, as you say, global Marshall Plan or aid, especially in the Islamic country and any country where elders are revered, you know, they look at a modern country where elders are just dead weight. Can't they die off so we don't have to take care of them? And it's a youth culture. Modern cultures are youth cultures, and that's scary to them. So, of course, I think community-based economics, ways of getting people out of suffering, of poverty, without falling into the problems that people are trying to work their way out of in the hypermodern cultures, really has to be part of the mix.
Yes, exactly right. And I talk about all this in my other book, the 2006 book, The Left Hand of God.
Right.
Taking back our country from the religious right. And my point there is very close to yours also, which is that the right has a good point. It has the wrong solution, but it really understands a real problem, and that is that the contemporary world does undermine love and community and mutual caring. Now, they think that that's because we are too liberal, and that's not the case. But it's actually because we have a world that has as its current bottom line maximizing money and power for each individual, rather than seeing any kind of community connection.
Right, and now, fortunately, with all this recent research showing that that's not the way to well-being, beyond a certain level of food, shelter, and clothing, that's not what brings happiness and well-being. It's the interrelationship with other people, with nature. We're completely composed of and function via relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to go back to my one big looming question about what I think is your really wise contribution here to thinking about the Israeli and Palestinian situation. When I listen to you, I think that would be difficult, but it could really happen. You know, if you could get people together, sitting down, saying, yes, we have heard it now. We do get it now. You're suffering. And we do take responsibility for overkill things that we did that caused that suffering. And we hear that you do the same. I really think that could be the foundation of new possibilities there. What worries me, what seems intractable about the situation are all the outside forces. And I'll just name four, but they're all the same force. In the 1980s, I met this woman who just happened to mention in a conversation that her uncle, who still lived in Lebanon, she was from a Lebanese-American family, was a member of a secret society pledged to drive Israel into the sea. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, came the new wave of Islamicists, which don't feel Israel should exist. And then you have the leader of Hamas, after that rocket attack, publicly saying what the president of Iran says, that there is no legal legitimacy for the state of Israel. That is our position. Now, to me, with all those forces bearing down, they're not going to be happy with a two-state solution. And I just wonder what you would do about that huge force bearing down on hoping for the destruction and elimination of Israel.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the thing is that these forces were not there 20 years ago or 30 years ago. The rise of Islamic fundamentalism is a rise. It happens. It's not in people's gene structure. It's in their reaction to the way the world has been moving.
Right.
And there is no, in my view, there is no solution unless we make a fundamental transformation in our own society in the West.
Mm.
If we can make, if we can move from the ethos of materialism and selfishness to what we at the network of spiritual progressives call a new bottom line. And the new bottom line is this, that we want every institution and social practice, every government institution, our corporations, our government policies, our school system, our legal system, our medical system, all to be judged efficient, rational, and productive, not only to the extent that they maximize money and power, which is the old bottom line, but also to the extent that they maximize love and caring, kindness and generosity, ethical and ecological sensitivity, enhance our capacity to respond to other human beings as embodiments of the sacred, and enhance our capacity to respond to the universe with awe, wonder, and radical amazement at the grandeur and mystery of all that is. That's our new bottom line. Now, we are trying to build a social movement, the Network of Spiritual Progressives. By the way, mm-hmm. It's online at spiritualprogressives.org. And there we lay out how to move in this direction. The Global Marshall Plan is part of moving in that direction. The Environmental and Social Responsibility Amendment that we've put forward that calls not only for overturning Citizens United, but also for banning all private money in elections, requiring that all public elections be publicly financed and no other source of money allowed. These are steps in the direction of building a movement with a new consciousness. Now, this is, when I first say it like this, it sounds very utopian. But so did the women's movement 40 years ago sound very utopian when they talked about eliminating or overcoming 10,000 years of patriarchy. And yet there's been an incredible transformation that has happened. Not that patriarchy is gone, but that the amount of change is unbelievable. We think we can do the same thing if we can get a spiritual movement that is not just about inner life, but also about inner life, but not only about inner life, but also about changing the bottom line in Western societies. That is what will free people in the Middle East to move, to say, I don't have to go with Hamas. I don't have to go with the fundamentalists. I can believe that it's possible for people to treat each other with kindness and generosity. And, of course, I'd like to see Israel take the first steps in that direction. I'm continually calling for Israel to be the one to take, to approach the Palestinian people in an open-hearted and caring way.
Mm-hmm.
But unless they look, given their trauma, they look to the West and they say, look, even the West that's not under these same kinds of threats that we're under, they still act as primarily from the standpoint of militarism, domination, fear of the other, now drones in the sky all over the place. I mean, so we have our business cut out for us right here. We can change the Middle East if we can change ourselves. And we can change ourselves if we're willing to adopt a real serious struggle for a new bottom line. And that's what this network of spiritual progressives is about. And I'm hoping that some of your people might want to join us.
I'd like you to tell us about the organization itself. I mean, we understand now this is their main project, a national security plan of generosity and care, as you call it. And I just want to stop here in case there are any young listeners who are not clicking with the reference to a Marshall Plan.
Yes.
Rabbi Lerner is making a reference here to the post-World War II Marshall Plan designed by General George C. Marshall, who was the Secretary of State, and it was to help with the reconstruction of Europe after the war. So he's using that model, which was so successful, for a global plan. So can you tell us about the organization? I was able to attend one of the conferences, which was so great, the one in Washington, D.C. in 2006. Mm-hmm. I remember...
Yes.
If I was up in the balcony, I was listening. I remember your speech and Sister Joan Chittister, such a powerful speech. She's just a force of nature. And so many other great people, you got involved with it.
Yes. And we have been setting up local chapters in different parts of the country. Right now, much of their focus is on trying to take this new perspective and bring it into the public arena to debate. Because in other words, we're at the stage that the women's movement was at 40 or 50 years ago when it first started to talk about patriarchy and sexism, and most people didn't even know what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't know what we're talking about when we say we want a world based on love, kindness, and generosity. They think, oh, well, that's just utopian nonsense, and that's idealistic, and we should keep it in Charlene Spretnik's show, but not in our church or our synagogue or our mosque or our ashram, but not bring it into the public sphere. And so what our local chapters are trying to do is to bring it into the public sphere. And we use things like the Global Marshall Plan or the Environmental and Social Responsibility Amendment to the U.S. Constitution as a way to raise these issues, because we're not thinking that this is going to happen immediately. What we are thinking is that the debate about it can be transformative, because many, many people really want a different kind of world, but they think that it's only them and the people in their particular church or synagogue or mosque or ashram or spiritual grouping or their friends, but they believe that everybody else is just out for themselves, and that is the fundamental thing that has to be undermined. We have to be able to show people that so many people want the same thing they want, only they just think that nobody else does, so they think they better keep it to themselves.
Mm-hmm. And another problem I wonder if your members have run into, I myself ran into this quite a few times, is in working with interfaith organizations, we'd be writing a draft of the charter or call to action or something, and I would put various ecological elements into it, and what I call the eco-social perspective and analysis. And when we come back for the next meeting, invariably that was crossed out of the draft, and it was explained to me through gritted teeth, Charlene, we can't sacrifice thinking about the poor to think about nature. So it was really a divide in the minds of religious people, and I wonder if your spiritual progressives have run into that resistance.
Oh, absolutely. And it's partly what we find is people saying, well, to be realistic, we need to narrow the focus.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, we think the opposite is true, that that to be realistic, you have to broaden the focus and help people see the big picture. And without that, they end up compromising and compromising and compromising until they end up being like Obama in his first term, in which he went so far away from what most people thought they had elected. And
pretty quickly.
Yeah, exactly. So we're I'm writing now my memoir.
Uh-huh.
And it's called Don't Be Realistic. because in a way what people mean by being realistic is that they have to take as a standard of what could be that which is right now. And whereas a spiritual person or religious person believes that there's something about the universe, we in Judaism call it God, that makes possible the transformation from that which is to that which ought to be.
That's
and so,
right. And the challenge is to stay open. I mean, as you say, don't start with your received assumptions and you're just thinking in that little box.
Right. Because we call that idolatry. Idolatry is not worshiping an idol. Idolatry is taking that which is and making it the criterion for what can be.
Okay,
and,
great. Well, be careful of that one, folks. That's a wonderful way to phrase that, which has to be overcome. We're out of time now, but Michael Lerner, Rabbi Michael Lerner, I want to thank you so much for coming on All Together Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, let's move over to the Arts Corner, see what we have this week. Our poem is by Louise Glück from her collection entitled The Seven Ages. Louise Glück has won the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry, the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Library of Congress's Bobbitt National Poetry Prize, and the Bollingen Prize. She's the author of 12 volumes of poetry and was selected to be the Poet Laureate of our country in 2003 and 2004. This poem has the same title as the collection is in, The Seven Ages. In my first dream, the world appeared, the salt, the bitter, the forbidden, the sweet. In my second, I descended. I was human. I couldn't just see a thing, beast that I am. I had to touch, to contain it. I hid in the groves. I worked in the fields until the fields were bare. Time that will never come again. The dry wheat bound, caskets of figs and olives. I even loved a few times in my disgusting human way, and like everyone, I called that accomplishment erotic freedom, absurd as it seems. The wheat gathered and stored, the last fruit dried, time that is hoarded, that is never used. Does it also end? In my first dream, the world appeared, the sweet, the forbidden, but there was no garden, only raw elements. I was human. I had to beg to descend. The salt, the bitter, the demanding, the preemptive. And like everyone, I took. I was taken. I dreamed. I was betrayed. Earth was given to me in a dream. In a dream, I possessed it. Now, our song this week is called Take Me On. It asks why people opt for confrontation when, as the refrain says, we're all in this together. This song is composed and performed by Tom Harker, ukulele man. It's from his CD entitled Crazy Old World. Here's Take Me On.
You want to turn around.
That was Take Me On by Tom Harker, Ukulele Man, from the CD entitled Crazy Old World. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you would like to see who the guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Join me next week when my guest will be Jonathan Porritt, the past chair of the British government's Sustainable Development Commission and a longtime deeply green thinker and activist. He'll be joining us from England. Till then, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.